copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Jerry Twombly, and I'm really glad to be with you.
So I really want to begin with giving you a kind of a definition of development. That's kind of a word that has different meanings to different people. You know, what is development? What is it that we're really trying to do? I know that I'm supposed to do development, but I'm not really sure even how to spell it and exactly what it means in terms of its relevance to me and the organization that I represent. So let me just kind of give you a definition. It's a definition that we've been using for years and years, and I think you'll find it to be helpful. I'm going to try to talk specifically to the various aspects of the definition that I think are really particularly relevant to where it is we want to go today. Development represents the things that we do. That's things that you and I are doing within the context of the organizations that we represent. It's the things that we do to build. So there's a process involved. Rational relationships with others. And so what it is that we're doing in the world of development, our world of development, you're all development directors, regardless of whether or not you see yourself that way. If you're a father, you're a development director, you're developing your children. If you're a mom, you're a development director because you're engaging with your children and teaching them the ways of the Lord. If you're involved in a church, you're a development director. If you have a small group, you're a development director. The realities are we're all doing development. We're all relating to people in different ways. And that's why this topic and what it is that we're going to be talking about today is entirely relevant to all of us, regardless of the roles that you play, whether it's the executive director, the senior pastor, a board member, or whatever of an organization that really is reaching out to meet the needs of people that you come in contact with. So it's the things that we do to build rational, that's the next word, relationships with others. So there are two operative words in that definition, and they need to be circled. The first one is relationships, circle relationships, because development really is all about relationships. And the other word is rational. That's a very important definition in our discussion, which you'll see in just a few moments. So let's first of all talk about relationships. Relationships are something that all of us enjoy. If I were to ask you to think of your a very special friend, someone that essentially you've known for most of your life, it might be a person that you went to school with, a person you went to college with, maybe a classmate friend of yours in college or seminary or whatever the case might be. It might be a former Sunday school teacher or a university professor that really had a real influence on your life. I mean, it could be, one of your siblings, and certainly those of you that are married, it could be your spouse. But the reality is all of us have kind of a best friend or two, people that we've taken the time to build a relationship with over the years. Now, if I were to ask you, and I'm going to ask you in just a few minutes, so I want you, this is probably the last question that I'll ask you as a group, unless I can think of a few others along the way. But let me just ask you a question. You know, think of a relationship that's very special to you, okay? Everybody gets somebody. When you have somebody in the back of your mind, just kind of like nod your head, okay? You get somebody? Somebody? Okay, all right. You're good. Well, you didn't nod your head. Okay, if you've got somebody in the mind, all right, you've got someone in the back of your mind as a very special friend, that if you were facing a crisis, this is a person that you'd really anxiously go to and really appreciate the input that they might provide in your life. What would be some of the words as you're thinking about that person and you're thinking about that relationship and how important it is to you? What would be some of the words that you would use, just a single word that you would use that might describe, why it's so important to you? Someone, and just any word. There's no wrong answer to this, okay? Personal. That there's something between you that just goes beyond another encounter. This is a person that I know. This is a person, that I can relate to in more intimate ways, perhaps, than I could with the average person that I might come in contact with. It's personal. It's very, very close, okay? What are some other words?
They actually care.
They care. They care. It's not like you're going to come to them and they're going to say, oh, come on, that's not important. I mean, regardless of what it is you might come to them with, they're going to be essentially responsive to what it is that you have to say. They care. They care deeply about you, and you care deeply about them. You had one.
Two words, actually.
Pardon me? Okay.
Mutual trust.
Mutual trust. You trust this person. In other words, you could come in varying degrees of goodness, for lack of a better term. I mean, you might really be a mess when you come to your friend and you're just grappling with stuff and you kind of know you're a mess. You kind of know that, you know, things aren't the way they should be. And you come to your friend, a mess, and you're accepted. They trust you. You trust them despite the fact that they, you know, perhaps that there are things that are happening in your life that you need to do something about, but you know what to do. But you trust them with not only the information that you're giving to them, but the information that they might give back to you in interacting with you and responding to your need. All right, other words?
Balance.
Balance? Now, what do you mean by that? That's a good one. That they balance you. They kind of keep the equilibrium. I mean, they kind of bring you off, you know, tangents that you might go on or they might go on, and we try to bring balance to one another. That's a great one. That's the first time I've heard that one, so thank you very much. Okay, other words?
Reliable.
Reliable? That they're just always there. You can call them 24/7 for all practical purposes, and you kind of know that they're going to be there regardless of the fact that it might be an inconvenient time of the day that you might call. But they're reliable. They're always there. Okay? Others?
Wisdom.
They have insight, wisdom, perspective. They can give you perspective. And sometimes we need perspective, don't we? We need to kind of, you know, get somebody else's look at a situation from a different perspective than what we have. And so they bring perspective to us. Okay? What would you think and for those of you that were in my network this morning, you can't answer the question because you already know the answer, but for those of you that weren't, you know, what would you say that defining characteristic of a relationship is? If there's one word that defines a relationship, what would you think it might be? Well, they didn't answer either, they would have if I had given them the opportunity, those that were there this morning. But basically, the defining characteristic of a relationship is that it's reciprocal. In other words, both parties benefit from the relationship, right? That if both parties didn't benefit from the relationship, you wouldn't have a relationship. You'd have what I call an arrangement. You see, there are a lot of organizations that have arrangements with the people that support them. If you give me money, and we'd certainly love to receive your money, and if you support our organization and you are engaged with us and supporting us in other practical ways, as long as you do that, we're going to just really love on you. We're going to make sure that you're just very, very special. We're going to send you cards. We may send you thank you notes. We may give you a gift at Christmas time. And if you're a really, 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 really big donor, then we might give you maybe a little bit better gift than we might give the average donor or whatever the case might be. But as long as you perform, everything's just fine. But if you were to stop, you know, becoming engaged, then the likelihood is that you probably wouldn't be treating these folks in much the same way. And that's fairly common to some degree, but the realities are, you know, there's the sense of the fact when that happens that you kind of have felt a bit manipulated. Have you ever felt manipulated? You know, when people have, you know, giving you all kinds of attention, they're just jumping all over you to try to engage you in practical ways, and then, you know, after you may respond to what it is that person is asking you to do, or if in fact you don't respond, either way, after whatever that event was, essentially you don't hear from that person anymore, and you kind of feel like, well, I was just used. All they were really pursuing me for was not because of who it is that I am. They were just pursuing me for they wanted what it is that I had. And it wasn't reciprocal. It was just manipulation. And so a relationship that's not reciprocal is an arrangement. And I think there are a lot of arrangements in life. I think a lot of marriages are kind of arrangements when you get right down to it. The illustration that I used this morning, I mean, my wife and I, you know, went on our honeymoon after we were married, and that's what everybody that does that gets married. But imagine, you know, after the marriage and the honeymoon, where we're kind of sitting down and negotiating some things that we didn't negotiate before in courtship. because we didn't have, you know, some of the issues that now we have in a new kind of relationship. So imagine this conversation. I'm sitting down with Sue, and I say, "Oh, Sue, we forgot to talk about some things, but, you know, of course it wasn't relevant now, but now that we're husband and wife and going to live with each other till death do us part, I guess we probably ought to have this conversation." And so I bring out a sheet of paper and I draw a line down the middle of it and I say, okay, I'm going to write Sue over here and I'm going to write Jerry over here. And I think it would be important for us to know, you know, who does what in the house so that we can kind of work together and all these things that are going to be a part of our lives now that we're married. And so let me just talk to you about what it is that I'm expecting you to do. Now, those of you that are ladies here are beginning to say, now what is he going to say? But let's say, and I didn't do this, by the way, so just, you know, before you throw rocks at me, okay, just know that I didn't do it this way. But let me suggest that I said, okay, now, you know, I mean, obviously you would, you know, take care of the house needs. You'd do the laundry and you'd make sure the house was always clean because, you know, I really don't like a mess and that everything was vacuumed before I came home. And then, of course, you'd bear the children that we would have and you would care for them and you would probably educate them and train them. You would look after the dogs and make sure that they never did anything bad in the house. You would prepare all the meals. And when I come home, you'd be dressed and you have your hair combed beautifully and you'd look just like you came out of a magazine, and I would come home and you would take my shoes off and you'd make sure that I was comfortable in my favorite chair, so that would be kind of the things that I would expect of you. Now, on my part, of course, I mean, I have responsibilities as well, and I certainly know that. I am going to work, okay, and I'm going to generate money, and I'll give you an allowance so that you basically can take care of the things that are on your side of the chart. I would contribute to providing the things that are needed to produce a child. I'll take care of that. I'll produce the children for us. You just take care of them and birth them and so forth. I'll take care of my part. You take care of your part. Let's see. What else am I going to do? I'm going to golf every Saturday morning. I usually leave about 7 or 7:30. I go out with the guys, and I'll come back around noon. Now, I'm going to be traveling all week, but I'm going to take my golf time because that's very important to me. These are really important relationships, as you clearly know. And let's see, is there anything else? No, I think that's pretty much what I'm going to do. This is what you're going to do. Now, I know your list is a little bit longer, but of course you don't work. And so you just, you know, kind of do that part, and I'll work and take care of that burden. And as long as you don't do anything on my side of the chart, perfectly fine. And I promise you, I won't do anything on your side of the chart. Now, all of a sudden, I suspect those feelings of warm hospitality and deep love that were expressed just the day before she looked into my eyes and said, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, are not necessarily the words that are going through her mind. She's probably saying, what kind of an idiot did I just marry? You know, what kind of a jerk did I just commit myself to for the rest of my life? Because this wasn't what I planned for, and it's not what any of us planned for. You know, what makes a relationship work is that it's reciprocal, that we're working together. I benefit, you benefit, we all benefit from this relationship. And that's what we're doing in the world of development. We're seeking to build, you know, those kinds of relationships with people that we recognize as having an interest, perhaps, in what it is that we do. Now, we're going to continue to develop that in just a few minutes. Now, the other word in the definition is the word rational. I had you circle that one as well, because we're talking about a certain type of relationship. You see, here's a phrase that I want you to remember. In the world of relationships, it's emotion that brings us together. It's rationalism that keeps us together. That's a very, very important phrase. Because if you think about relationships, whether it's with an individual or whether it's with an organization, if you're thinking about an individual, we're all drawn to people initially emotionally. Think about marriage. There was a time in which I saw Sue for the first time, and she was, I can tell you where she was, where she was standing, I can tell you what she was wearing. She had long dark hair and braces on her teeth. She sparkled when she smiled. I mean, she was just a remarkable person. She was witty, she was smart, she was intelligent, intuitive, and all these wonderful virtues that I could see almost immediately. And there was something that happened. And it's, you know, love is hard to explain, isn't it? It's not like, I mean, she's like really, really different. And it was emotion that drew us together. In the context of your organization, people are going to initially support your organization, engage with you in the ministry in which you're involved, they're going to initially do that and be moved emotionally. And stop and think about the organization of which you're a part. You know, you were a part of an organization. You're supporting some organizations, perhaps financially, that you became involved in years ago. But initially, you were drawn to them emotionally. But there's something, you know, unique about emotions, and that is that they're kind of ethereal, aren't they? They just kind of, you get really feeling in love, and then something happens, and then you get kind of not feeling the same way that you felt before, and you kind of want to feel that way again in the future and so forth. I mean, you know that they're kind of, and it's true of all emotions, love and anger. You know, there's very few times in my lifetime that I have really gotten, you know, really, really angry. I mean, normally I just kind of can walk away from things, but I think probably twice that I can remember that I just kind of flew off the handle. I mean, I got really upset about something. And I kind of expressed it in ways that probably weren't appropriate. Now, my wife is very, very kind, and it wasn't her that I was angry with, but it was something that she was, you know, essentially there when I kind of blew up. And later, the next morning, she says, well, you were, or like 2 days later, she says, you were really angry on Saturday. I says, yeah, I really was. What was it that I was really angry about? I mean, like I couldn't even remember what it is that I was angry about, but at the moment it seemed like something really worthwhile to be angry about. But it's a very fleeting thing. Emotions are a fleeting thing. So in the world of development, what we're trying to do is we're trying to build relationships with a particular quality. And when I talk about rational, I would like to see that as a kind of a synonym of substance. Like substantive relationships. You really got something to hold on to, right? That's substantive. And the longer you're married to someone, the longer you have loved someone, the longer you live in relationship with someone, the more substantive the relation comes or becomes, isn't it? Because you understand a little bit more about each other, and you tend to appreciate the fears, the concerns, the interests, the feelings of the person that you're in love with. And that's substantive, that's rational. And so you have to understand that rationality doesn't displace emotion, but it just makes emotion grow deeper. My dad and mother, my mother died before my dad, and she died about 6 days before their 70th wedding anniversary. And they've been married for 70 years. And I've seen pictures of my parents that were taken about 75 years ago. And they both look like they'd swallowed a canary, you know, they're like, and you know, when it's your father, you know, and I remember them showing that picture when I was like 20 years old, they kind of brought it out of the archives and they showed us this one picture of them standing on a rock looking like they'd swallowed a canary. And I just looked at it and says, Dad, I mean, it's like you don't expect your father to look like that and your mother to look, you know, so giddy and happy as they obviously were. And so you could tell that they were really in love. But when my mother died, she was in a nursing home at the time. And people at the nursing home called my dad one afternoon and she said, well, you'd probably need to come. Because the realities are we knew that she was close to death and there was indications that only a professional physician or a nurse would recognize as being kind of the last time, period of time in one's life. And so Dad drives down to the nursing home and he just holds my mother until she passed away and into the hands of the Lord. And I have that image in my mind of my dad holding my mother and I'm saying, you know, he really loved her. But I'm sure that the love was a whole lot deeper than it was in the 75-year-old picture of them standing on a rock, you know, on the coast of Maine. So that's what I mean by rational. And so what we really want to do is we want to build relationships. And rational relationships, interestingly enough, are sustainable because they're rooted in something other than just emotion. But if you have a relationship that's just rooted in emotion alone, you can't assume that it's going to be sustainable over the long term. So what our organizations need is relationships with people who are going to hang with us for a good long time. We hope that they'll partner with us in ways that are going to enable us to do what it is that we've been called of God to do. Okay? So that's the definition of development. Now, there's another phrase that I want to introduce to you, and it's one that I think will become clearer as
we work through the diagram that you have in your notes. So there is a diagram that I will make reference to, and we'll kind of create it again here in front of you. But it's a phrase that goes something like this. What you need more than donors, because many of you came here because, and many people come to my network because it's fundraising an organization. So I really don't like the title. I've never liked being even associated with the word fundraising, despite the fact that I have had a great deal of success in the context of my life in helping organizations raise literally millions of dollars. But I've never seen myself as a fundraiser, and I hate it when somebody introduces me as one. I mean, it happens periodically if I'm speaking at a conference or a convention or something, and someone will say, well, here's Jerry Twombly, and he's a fundraiser. And it's, if they're introducing me to a person, it's always interesting to see what they do next, because usually they kind of step back like this. And, oh, here's Jerry Twombly, and you're a fundraiser. I mean, it's like, you know, I don't want to talk to you because I don't want to be, you know, harangued out of something that I really don't want to participate in. And so I have never liked that, and I've actually never even seen myself that way. So, but what we need more than donors, and despite the fact that we all need donors, I suspect that all of you would say, yeah, that would be nice to have more donors to our organization than we have right now. That's really kind of like really important. But what we need more than donors is we need partners. And your first objective in building a ministry and growing a ministry is to really engage partners. You want people to come alongside, to lock arms with you and walk with you in fulfilling the mission, the vision to which you've committed yourself. And let me tell you something about partners and donors. In the case of partners, partners always become donors. Always. Now, they may not give gifts, but they're always going to give something. And they're going to give generously, and they're going to give sacrificially on your behalf. That's always the case with partners. But there's another thing you need to remember, and that is that donors rarely become partners. See, partners always become donors, but donors rarely become partners. And you know why? Because the donor thinks that the only reason that you want to have a relationship with him is because he writes checks. And so he writes checks, and you spend the checks, and you put them into the bank account, and you use them. And then when you have another need, you go back to him, and you ask him for another check, and he gives you another check, and you go and spend it, and so forth. So his perception of his value to your organization is as a donor. But the realities are that everybody that's a donor has other things that might be of greater value than what it is he could write a check for. Now, let's say that, you know, Bill Gates, who happens to be a very wealthy person, one of the wealthiest persons in the world, and if Bill Gates writes you a check for $1 million, you say, well, gee, that's great. You know, maybe he'll write one for $1 million next year, and that would be good too. And so you accept his $1 million check. But is that the best that Bill Gates could do for your organization? Probably not. In fact, he might be able to do a whole lot more things that would be more valuable than $1 million check, or $100,000 check, or a $10,000 check, or a $5,000 check. Not to say that that's not important, but the point is that what he has to offer. I mean, think about a man like Bill Gates, who probably knows every other wealthy person in the world. He can probably open doors to corporations, businesses, and other people that you would never be able to open in a gazillion years. But if he really loved your organization, was a partner with you in helping you to do what it is that you want to do, he might say, you know, I need to send you to about 7 different people that really would love to be a part of this, and you'd never have gotten in before. And you know something? That could be worth more than $1 million, a whole lot more than $1 million. So every time you take a gift, always keep in mind what it is that you might be leaving on the table in terms of what it is that someone could do. Now, with all those thoughts in mind, I want to talk to you about, you know, the relational process. Now, I typically, you know, speak at a lot of different kinds of events, and oftentimes when they greet me at the airport or picking me up to take me to an event that I'm supposed to be speaking at, you know, the person that usually picks me up is the development director or the president of the organization or somebody who basically is really struggling with these issues that basically I come to try to help address. And so, you know, we'll be riding down the road and the person will say, you know, man, this development stuff, whew, this is really, really tough. I mean, I've been involved in ministry for the last 37 years, and let me tell you, I've never had anything this tough. And I just look at him and say, this is like the easiest stuff ever. And he says, no, this isn't easy. This is really tough stuff. I tell you, I've been involved in nonprofit ministries for years, and this is really tough stuff. Here, there you go. It's been a long day. And my response again is, no. You really don't understand. It is really easy. This is so easy. And he says, well, it may be easy for you. I says, no, it's going to be easy for you because you have experience. He says, what do you think we brought you here for? I don't have any experience in this. And the realities are, you know, we just don't know how to do it. I says, no, you have experience. And everybody on your staff has experience. Everybody in your development department has experience. Everybody has experience in development. And he says, I just don't get it, Jerry. And I said, no, you don't. But let me tell you, you have experience. And he says, well, how do I have experience? I says, have you ever fallen in love? He says, oh, yeah, several times. I says, well, then you have experience. You understand development. You see, one of the greatest analogies of development is falling in love. Because if you've ever fallen in love, then you understand development. Do you know in our country, in America, the average time between someone meeting someone for the first time that they'd never seen before, because that's usually what happens when you get married, you come and meet the person that you eventually marry or you fall in love with, and there was a time when you didn't even know they existed, you know, remember? I mean, I can remember, I grew up in Maine, okay, that's really like far east of the United States. My wife grew up in Wisconsin, okay, which is right kind of in the middle of the state. It's called the dairy state, so they a lot of cows in Wisconsin. My wife is Polish, which really makes me extremely welcome in Poland. She's Polish, and we were like Americans, you know. I don't even know what we were. We just kind of showed up on the beach one day, and you know, who knows who we are? We've never been able to figure it out, but. I think we were from England eventually or earlier. But the whole point where we came from totally different backgrounds. My father was a fisherman. Her father was a tool and die maker at an auto manufacturing plant. And he happened even worse, at least from my father's perspective, he happened to be the president of the labor union of that particular factory. Well, my dad didn't really have an awful lot of good to say about labor unions. And so here we have two different people, two different backgrounds, two different cultures. We come together, we meet at the same place at the same time. And 10 months after that meeting, we were standing in front of a pastor saying, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, until death do us part. Now the question is, what happened? What happened in 10 months that would cause me to make that kind of a commitment to a person, to commit my life to her until I died? Well, if you get it, you understand development. The average tenure, actually in America, if you're just curious, is 1.2 years. 1.2 years from the time that they first meet to the time that they commit their lives to each other. Now, sometimes I was talking this morning with my group, and I, some people, you know, took a little bit longer. Anybody less than 10 months married that, you know, had a courtship for less than 10 months? Am I the winner today? Whoa. Okay. Who's next after 10 months? Anybody like within a year or a year and a half or so?
Year and a half.
Oh, well, there you go. That's good. And, you know, it all changes, obviously, for everyone. But the realities are, it doesn't necessarily take all that long in some instances. And we have, obviously, a very wonderful marriage for which I'm very, very grateful. Okay, so now we're going to talk about Sue, all right? So this is Sue right here. And this is Jerry down here. And this is Sue and Jerry before they even had met anybody. Okay? And she's in Wisconsin. I'm in Maine. And we didn't even know each other existed. Now, there came a point in time, and this is, we're trying to, and as you see this, what we're trying to do is we're trying to essentially replicate a process that took place in falling in love that basically needs to be replicated in anything you do developmentally. So just kind of think about what it is I'm going to say with you, and then, or say to you, and then ask yourself the question, what would be a counterpart to that within my world of my nonprofit? Okay, so just so that you're keeping that in mind. Now, let's just put a diamond here. And that diamond is when we stood in front of a pastor and committed ourselves for the rest of our lives to be with one another.
Okay, so that's when that happens, and that's what that represents. Well, the first thing that happened was basically being placed in a situation where I would see her for the first time. In other words, I came to my sister's house, who invited me. Sue came to my sister's house, who had invited her. And here we were at the same house at the same time. I walked upstairs when the doorbell rang, and there she was standing. Okay? So that was the first time I had ever laid eyes on her. And I was really, you know, kind of taken back, because I wasn't really expecting the feelings that I had, the response that I had when I saw her. I certainly was having a hard time kind of grappling with the emotions of it, because they were just kind of flying all over the place, which is oftentimes the case in those situations. And so we had a wonderful evening together. We sat and talked. My sister, who is 2 years older than I am, I have two sisters. I'm the youngest of three, so I was totally abused as a child. I had two perfect older sisters. And my second sister, who's 2 years older than I am, and we were always very, very close as siblings. We lived out in the country, kind of, and there wasn't any playmates around. You know, we didn't have playmates. And so we were play partners, you know, as when we were kids. And my sister always kind of dictated what it is that we were going to be playing, because she was older and she was kind of dominant, and so we'd always play house. And I was always Mrs. Johnson. So I have no, you wonder why I'm so stable now, and maybe you're saying, well, that's what's wrong with him. You know, he was playing Mrs. Johnson with his sister when he was like 5 years old, or whatever the case might be. But that was my sister, and we've always been close. We went to college together, the same college together, And so there was a period in my life when my sister came to me and called me on the phone, and she said, "Jerry, you're probably thinking about, you know, marriage." And it was kind of the call out of nowhere, you know. I mean, like, where's she coming from? And I said, "Well, I guess, yeah, I'm probably thinking about it." And she says, "Well, I just called to tell you, you don't need to worry about it." And I'm thinking, this is my crazy sister, you know. And I say, "Well, you know, I really don't think I've been worrying too much about it." And she says, but why would you say that?" And she says, "Because you don't have the sense to find one that would be good for you. So don't worry, I'm going to find the girl that you're going to marry." I'm like, I'm really annoyed with her. I'm just like ready to hang up the phone, which I did quite quickly after. And I says, "Well, really, thanks, but I think I'm probably capable of doing it myself." She says, "No, you're not. Good day." And I hung up the phone. And so I didn't pay too much attention, because she's my sister and she does things like that, and so I didn't think too much about it until about 6 months later. She calls me up and she says, "Well, you know, I met this girl named I know this girl named Sue. I've known her for like 13 years, and I've been kind of watching her for 13 years, and she really loves the Lord, and she's really, you know, lovely. She's just a beautiful gal, and she's got a real heart for God, a real tender heart for God. She's smart as a whip, and she's got a PhD in psychology, and she's, you know, working as a clinical psychologist in this wonderful hospital of ours, and so she has so many aspirations that are similar to yours. It's like you're walking up opposite sides of the mountain, and you're kind of like at the same place." And she says, "You know, I think maybe, you know, you need to get to meet her." And so now I'm kind of thinking, well, maybe she's not as dumb as I thought she was. And so I'm saying, "Well, gee, this is maybe pretty good." I says, "When are you going to introduce me to her?" She says, "Oh, no, you're not ready yet." And by this time, I'm ready to throw something at her. I mean, she's just like my sister. Well, eventually, she introduced us. So that's kind of how it happened. But what you need to do is essentially replicate, how do you bring people that don't know anything about you, that have no idea about your ministry, that don't understand what it is that you're called of God to do, who really don't have a clue in terms of what it is that you're all about, how do you bring them to places where they can be exposed to you for the first time? It may be that you go to them, it may be that they come to you. It may be that you sit down in an elevator, and I've had stranger things happen. I'm sitting in an airplane, and I'm talking to people, and all of a sudden, because I talk to everybody. I kind of like to talk to people. I'm an extrovert, so I kind of go look for people. You know, if I'm bored, I'm just going to go find somebody to talk to, because it just seems like it would be a good thing to do. My wife is an introvert. She doesn't go looking for people to talk to. But when they go to her, they stay longer. That's the thing. That's a difference between an extrovert and an introvert, because I'll talk to you, and then I got to go over here and talk to you, and then I got to talk to you, and then I got to run over and talk to you. And Sue will just sit with someone for, you know, an hour or 2 hours and just have a wonderful time. And that's the difference between an extrovert and an introvert. Okay, so, but how do you do that? I sit on airplanes and I'll talk to people, and all of a sudden, and it's really unbelievable some of the connections that I've made, because eventually, you know, there's something in common, and then I'll ask them a question, and then eventually the guy says, "Is that what you do?" I said, "My wife works for a theater, and she really needs to learn some of the things that you know." And I said, "Well, have her give me a call," and lo and behold, she gives me a call. And so I get working with all these kind of interesting situations, but those are exposure opportunities. Now, there's another part of this that I'm not going to talk about, but it's something that may be in another section that you'll want to listen to if it's available. I'm not even sure that I've looked at what I'm speaking on this week. Okay, the next step was a first date, okay? So we kind of remember that too, don't we? The first date is kind of characterized by something that's quite common, and that is the personal pronoun. See, the personal pronoun, I and me, basically, I am trying to convince Sue that I am the best take ever. You know, I am trying to convince her that you really don't want to miss this opportunity. And so I am kind of, you know, telling her about myself. Now, my sister had done a pretty good job telling her about me, so I really couldn't fib too much because she kind of knew the real truth. And so, but I'm trying to say, you know, she says, "Well, you have your own business." And I said, "Oh yeah, I do." And she said, "Well, how did you do that?" I said, "Well, let me tell you." And I'm kind of like just making her think that I'm just like the next, you know, Bill Gates or something. I don't know. But anyway, she's trying to, and then, but to my credit, she was doing the same thing, but she was, you know, women are just so much more subtle, you know. She says, "Well," I said, "Well, did you go to college?" She says, "Yeah." I says, "Well, where did you go to college?" And she says, "Well, which one?" And I said, "Well, how many did you go to?" And she says, "Six." And I'm thinking, "Oh, okay." "And how many degrees do you have?" "Let's see. Let me count them now. There's 1, 2, 3, 4. I have 5. And I says, "Well, that's really good. What did you do in the sixth school?" Or the sixth, you know, degree, or whatever the case might be. But you know, she's like, you know, really. But we're trying to convince each other that we really would determine whether or not this could be something that could work, right? And that's what you're doing. And after the first date, it wasn't more than 24 hours that I called her and said, "Hey, listen, I got tickets to a ball game. Would you like to go?" And she says, "Yes." And that was really a good sign, because she had dated a lot of other guys, and they'd call her back, and they would say, "Well, Sue, do you have something to do tomorrow?" And she says, "No." I mean, "Yes." "And do you have something to do on Friday?" "Yes." "What about Saturday?" "Yes." She says, "In fact, I'm busy for the next 365 days, which means that I really don't want to talk to you." Okay, so when she said yes to me, I'm thinking, yes, you know, and so we went on a second date. And the second date, it becomes a little bit different, doesn't it? Because on the second date, what you're doing is you're taking the conversation to a different direction. You're talking about, well, what is it that interests you? What are the things? I mean, we're now talking about, you know, one another, and we're learning a little bit more about each other, which is always the case, because every time that we meet, we're growing a little bit deeper. Now, let me show you this. It's emotion. Remember I said it's emotion that brings us together. It's rationalism that keeps us together. But you need to understand that emotion doesn't displace, or rationalism doesn't displace emotion. What happens is that it just grows it deeper. You see, this is where my parents were when they got married. This is where they were when my mother died. An incredibly deep relationship, very, very emotional, still to the point that, you know, and when I fly home, I'm flying home on Thursday. I'll be home next Thursday night, and we have a little special pickup place, you know, that I just kind of walk out, and I know, and she knows where it is, and so she waits in a cell phone lot until I get there. As soon as I get off the plane, I call her, because it takes her so many minutes to get from the, and I can stand out there, and I can see the car coming around the drive to pick me up, and as soon as I see the car, my heart starts beating a little bit faster, and I just get, because I just can't wait to see her again. So that the emotion, despite the fact that many years have passed since that particular time, the emotion has grown only deeper, but I still, you know, I understand her a whole lot better. So The first thing is replicating these first three steps, and it needs to be done relatively soon, practically speaking, usually within, you know, 1 to 2 weeks. In other words, and you can do it, you know, relatively, you know, as somebody comes and you might say, you know, at the exposure event, we have two or three things that we'd like you to consider if you have any interest. You know, I'd love to sit down with you and have a cup of coffee and kind of share with you a little bit about what we're doing, just so that you'd understand that a little bit. And that might be one thing. And, you know, whenever you're presenting opportunities to people where you're asking them to consider, you know, things that, you know, they might be willing to sit down and talk to you about, usually it's, you know, I would suggest always having three or four options. Whenever you have one option, that's not a good situation necessarily, because it's a 50-50 chance that they're going to say yes or no. You have two, the odds change a little bit. And so usually when I'm talking to people, I says usually when people are, you know, come and are exposed to our ministry, they kind of get intrigued because of what it is that we do and how we go about doing it. And I don't know if you have any interest, but if you should have an interest, let me just share with you four or five things that you might want to consider. You know, one is that I'd just love to take you out for a cup of coffee and explain what it is we do, and I'm not going to ask you for any money. I'd just like to explain it. You know, maybe you'd like to get our newsletter or whatever the case might be, but you really want people, you know, yes in the world of development, okay, yes is a good word. No is a bad word. And the default answer is always no. Okay, just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. Yes is a good word because it keeps doors open. I mean, we're not asking people to give us a gift. We're not asking them to make a sacrifice on our part. We just really, you know, a significant sacrifice. I mean, time is a sacrifice if you stop and look at it that way. But the point is, we just really want to explore whether or not this is something that they might want to partner with us in helping us to fulfill. And so we usually provide, you know, four or five opportunities that they might want to consider. And maybe that sitting down and having a cup of coffee is like a first date. And we're just kind of talking about one another. Do you have any questions about what it is we do? I mean, if you were in our situation, you know, did you see things that you, as you watched them and you saw them unfold, that brought about some level of curiosity? Was there some things that you wondered why they were being done this way or whatever? And just kind of, you know, ask them questions and try to assess, you know, whether or not this is something that might be of interest to them. Well, you know, after this one, and then this, what I call this a bridge, okay? These are bridges that move us from one place to another. And the bridges are usually a series of opportunities that people might be willing to consider if they have any interest in moving forward in any kind of a relationship with us. And this is something that needs to be done. And by the way, it's the most frequent mistake made in the world of development, and that's the failure to bridge. The failure to connect one event with another by providing opportunities wherein people can kind of continue the journey, if in fact they want to continue the journey. They ought to be given the opportunity to do so if in fact that's something they would like to do. And so those are kind of bridges. And they have to happen quickly only because emotion is fleeting. You know, they may walk away from your organization being horribly excited about what you do, and then tomorrow morning kind of forget about how excited they were about it, and so when you call them 2 days later, they even forgot that they were there. And you know that that's kind of possible, despite the fact that it's surprising, all right? So then there are all these things that are happening here. You know, I meet her parents, I meet her friends, she meets my parents. We sit up late in the restaurant talking and talking and talking and talking until they kick us out. You know, we make decisions here to do things together and so forth. And all these things, all these events, and there are literally hundreds if not thousands of them perhaps, but all these things that really help us to grow in our understanding. We're becoming increasingly more we understand a little bit more about each other as we work through this process. But there's something that happens somewhere in the middle. And it happens in all relationships, and it's very, very significant. And it happens right about here. Okay? And right about there, you know, if we're using the falling in love and getting married analogy, right about there we have, you know, essentially what's, you know, I call the hypothetical conversation. And if you're married and if you've been through the courtship process, you remember the hypothetical conversation. It went something like this. You know, we've had, you know, it's just some wonderful times together. I tell you, I've really enjoyed this so much. And, you know, the realities are we've been dating here now for several months. And, you know, maybe we need to talk about something. And she says, well, what would that be? I said, well, and I'm kind of, you know, trying to pace this, you know, so that it doesn't sound too awkward. I said, what if we were to consider taking this to the next level? Now notice what happened. See, all up to this point, the pronouns have been I and me. But all of a sudden, now the pronouns change to we and us. And you kind of remember, and everything in the relationship changed from that moment. Because now you're taking ownership of the relationship. Now you're saying, you know, what could we do? And everything changes. And you probably remember that happening when all of a sudden the pronouns change and now the relationship has gone to a totally different level almost immediately. And now we're talking about things that we didn't talk about before. And then eventually, the further you go down the road, we're talking about wedding preparations and all the other things, you know, that obviously become a part of bringing us to this particular point. But this is very, very important. And this is something that needs to be replicated in the world of development. So I won't take too time telling this story, but I do want to tell you something, a story that I think will be helpful. A number of years ago, we were raising money for a high school in Arizona. They're needing to raise several million dollars to build a new facility. They asked me to come down and talk to them about it. So here's the things that I did, and just kind of follow this, if you will, because it really is somewhat important to this discussion. I knew what they needed to do. And I asked them this question. I said, and this is a question that I would ask you. Think about, you know, where what you want to do with your ministry, where you want to go with your ministry. And then imagine, I said, let's just imagine, you know, in this particular case, you know, that we are successful in getting this job done, this $7 million that we need to build this new building. You know, let's just assume that we're successful and it's a wonderful thing and we're coming back here, you know, 10 years from now and all of this thing has happened. And not only do we have a building, but we have, you know, people coming out of that building that, you know, love the Lord and are serving the Lord and so forth. If you were to stand 10 years from now looking at success, what groups of people would you perceive as having been critical to that success? In other words, what I want you to do is I want you to project the kinds of people that you think need to be involved in your organization to literally, I mean, practically speaking, God can do anything that he wants, but I think he gives us a brain for a purpose. You know, what groups of people would you perceive as being critical, a critical part of your ability to succeed? And they said, oh, yeah, well, Christians. I mean, that's usually the way we start out. You know, it's really kind of, you're up at 60,000 feet, you know, flying away and say, well, Christians. Well, let's kind of be a little bit more specific, okay? Well, Christian professionals. Okay, that's another level down. Now we've just dropped to, you know, 50,000 feet or whatever. And then down and down and down. So eventually what we did is we came up with a list of groups of people. And they were kind of really narrow. This was a denominational church. And so one of the things, it was a denominational church school, and there were several churches within that denomination in the area. And so one of the groups that they identified as being a critical, practically speaking, to the success was denominational people within the denomination that owned their own businesses. And there happened to be a lot of them, and they knew that. There were a lot of, you know, very influential business people, you know, who loved the Lord and who were a part of the denomination and who were kind of, you know, really, you know, devoted to this denominational school. And so I said, well, who are they? And they said, well, we know some of them. And so eventually we went through a process, and I won't bore you with the details, but we came up with 63 names. 63 names of people within, you know, that large city who went to one of these denominational churches that was either the president or the executive director, but had very influential positions in management of companies. And so the next question goes something like this. Who are the critical members of the critical group? In other words, every group has
people that are movers and shakers in it, right? I mean, you probably, if I gave you a church directory where you go to church, and maybe let's say you've been going to that church for the last 20 years, and if I were to give you a highlight pen and a membership directory, and I said, will you tell me who the movers and shakers are in your church? Most of you could do it within probably 20 seconds or 30 seconds, depending on the size of your church. It might take a minute if you have a really large church. But the point is, you probably know who they are, because these are the people that others are looking to for direction. And we went through a process where we got 13 names out of those 63 of people that basically their peers recognized as being very, very important in kind of shaping the direction of things and just kind of shaping the opinions of people. And so we decided that we really wanted to talk to those people. Now, it doesn't have to be this way, but this is the way it was done in this situation. And so we just brought them to the table. We said, we'd like you to come to a meeting. We'd love to talk to you about what it is we're doing. It's not going to be for raising money. Just please understand that. That's not the purpose of us getting together. We have an issue that we're trying to grapple with. We need your input and wisdom if we're going to successfully move forward. And all of them came. Okay, they all came to the meeting. So now let's assume that I'm the director of the school. I'm the kind of the administrator of the school, and you're kind of like one of the 13 business people, businessmen and businesswomen. And I say, you know, really thanks for coming. Hope you enjoyed the breakfast. We have our waiters and waitresses here that are now filling up your coffee cup and taking your plates away. But listen, thanks so much for coming. Don't want to take too much of your time. Let me just give you kind of an overview of where we're going. In front of you, there is a couple of sheets of paper. As you can see, it tells a little bit about our vision for what it is that we're going to be doing at the school. Most of you know our situation. We're in a bad section of town. We can only take 70 students in every class, and we have students coming up from our elementary school programs, classes of 200 and 300, and we only can accommodate essentially this number of people at our current facility. We bought a piece of property. It's kind of centrally located to all of our congregations, and we're preparing to build a building. And all of the details and all the statistics, all the research that has been done, is included in the material that you have in front of you. I hope you take a look at it. If you have any questions, one of the reasons why, and we told them why they were selected. We told them that we wanted, you were identified as a group of people that were critical to the overall success of what it is that happens oftentimes in the things that we do as a denomination. And people, your peers said that you are the people that they would go to if they were seeking for direction. So we want to make sure you have all the information that you need. And that whole process took no more than like 3 or 4 minutes. But I said, the reason we brought you together is this reason. What we really want to ask you, if you were in our situation and you were facing this challenge, what would you do? We've never done this before. I mean, literally, we have never had a campaign in the history of our school. We have never done anything that's even remotely looks like this. We're kind of clueless at one level. We've done the due diligence stuff that we knew we needed to do. But right now, we just need help. We need input. We need people who really understand how things work and in the areas in which we're working. And could you just help us to understand what it is that we could do? And as soon as you know they understand the question, just sit down and listen to them. I've told people for years that I have built a career, and I'm not being facetious, that I have built a career around pleading ignorance. And I don't mean to say that in any kind of a manipulative way. I mean, the realities are, most of the time I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never worked in this particular community. I'd never worked among this particular group of people. There's a lot of things that I didn't understand and I knew I didn't understand. And what I've discovered, that if you just ask questions, people are more than willing to respond to you. And they're quite anxious to do it because you know what? Not many people ask them questions. They ask them for money. And really what you really want to do is you really want to get, who they are and to give, understand and gather what it is that they can bring to the table that was going to enable you to be more successful in what it is that you've been called of God to do. And so I just sat down that day and I sat down with a piece of paper and I'm just kind of writing all those things that they're telling me. And I'm thinking, man, that's wrong. I never would have thought of that. 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 And you know what happened? About midway in the conversation, it changed. When somebody stood up and says, well, Jerry, it says you won't be able to do that, but we can help you. And all of a sudden, everything changed because the pronouns changed. We can help you. We're really more than anxious to help you. And then, you know, everything changed. And that was really the beginning of probably, that was probably the first time that we've ever done that. You know, that was probably 25 years ago now. And the realities are, it's been a central critical point of our consulting work with clients, is just urging them to sit down with people that are vested in who you are as an organization, gather input, ask them for their help, ask them for their insights, give them the opportunity to ask you any question, invite them to share their ideas and how you might be able to do it. And when they all become partners, then essentially what happened is they all became donors. But became donors because we made they were invited to become partners before they were invited to become donors. And that process needs to be replicated. Now, we continue to go until we get to this point. All right, commitment. Now there are two things that can happen here. One is we can now go through life as a married man and as a married woman. Okay? So we kind of drift apart. We connect periodically, but the realities are, you know, something's happening and you kind of know that it's happening. And you know, we use the word manipulation a little bit today. And some people say, well, you know, how do I know if I've been manipulative? You know, I've been manipulative. How can I know that? Because you don't want to be, I don't want to be, you don't want to be. I understand that. But how can I know? Well, let me tell you how you can know. It's really easy. If you don't put as much energy into sustaining a relationship as you did to secure it, okay? If you don't take as much energy to work this part of the continuum as you did to do this part of the continuum, then you probably have been manipulative. You see, it's like we put a lot of energy into this. And this was, we made lots of sacrifices. We would have done anything to try to get our loved one to, you know, encourage and feel good about themselves and the relationship and so forth. We worked so hard to this till we get to this point. And then we almost look like, well, I've gotten that part of my life taken care of. Now I'm married. Now I'm going to go on to another part of my life. And we ignore what happened here. And we didn't put as much energy into this as we did into this. And then catastrophe takes place. And it happens institutionally all the time. All the time. Now, you know, development just isn't that hard. It's just really not that difficult because you've all been a part of that. You've all done the things that I just shared as you were falling in love with the person, perhaps those of you that are married, with a person that you fell in love with. You had this conversation. You had this part. You had this part. You had this part. You all did it. So all you're trying to do is to replicate it because we just really want to engage people first as partners. Don't worry about the donor thing. That will come. Just do what it is that you need to do. Engage them in the conversation. Provide them opportunities to be able to have input. And the only way you're going to get meaningful input from somebody is to ask them a question. To ask them a question. And you don't have to have a group of people in order to do that. I was sitting next to a guy the other day, and this will be the story that I'll close with, but... And the other day was probably 2 years ago now. We were working with a project in another state of the country. And it was a little tiny small town. They had a school of about 450 students. And they needed to raise like $4 or $5 million, and which was like really hard in this, you know, town of 2,500 people. So I went to the administrator, did the same thing I did to the people in Arizona. I said, hey, you know, if this thing's going to be successful, you know, you're going to need to engage a lot of people. I says, who are the movers and shakers in this town? Who are the most influential people in this town, the people that set the opinion of others? And he gave me a list of all their names and their addresses and their phone numbers. I says, I want to go talk to every one of them. He says, okay. So I went and talked to them. I told them, I'm not going to ask them for any money. You just need to know that. I just really want to talk to them. So I went and talked to them. You know what happened? What I know is that I've never lived where you live. But you know something? I know that in every town that I have ever been in, there are a lot of landmines around. you know, figuratively speaking, things that I could step on and get blown up on, you know, that I didn't even know were there. But you know, there's always somebody in town knows where all the landmines are. And so I'm just trying to find where the landmines are, because there's no necessary, it's not necessary to, you know, get blown up if you don't need to get blown up. And so I'm just thinking, I want to know where the landmines are. And so I just sat down with people and I said, you know, and I would, the conversation would go something like this. I have experience in doing what it is that they've asked me to do. I mean, we've done a lot of these kinds of projects, but I've never done one in this community. And you know something? I don't have a clue how to do it in this community. And so I just came to just ask you a bunch of questions, because I think this is a worthy project. I think it's one that's worthy to be funded. But I don't know how to approach it. So I'm just talking to people like you to get your input. You know, is it a needed project? Is it, you know, what can be done? You know, are there people that I need to talk to before I ever go and do anything else? I mean, can you just help me? And honestly, whenever you come that way to anyone, they're very, very open to hear you and listen to you and to help you. I've just never had anybody that wouldn't help me. And I went to the final meeting, and it was a banker. He's a young guy. He's probably in his early 40s. And of course, young is a relative term, the older you get. Anybody less than 70 is young to me. But the reality is, he's a pretty young guy. And he was an extrovert, so we kind of, you know, bounced against each other in nice ways. I mean, I just really liked the guy. And so finally, at the end of the meeting, I said to him, his name was Dale. And I handed him a piece of paper. I said, Dale, if you were me, how would you do this project? He says, you got a piece of paper? I says, yeah. So I gave him a piece of paper. He came down, he put like six circles on a piece of paper, kind of horizontally. He says, well, you know, you have to first of all understand that there are different groups within our community. We have farmers, then we have a whole lot of infrastructure that basically supports the farming industry. And so we have bankers, and we have suppliers, you know, that provide the agricultural needs for the farmers. There's a very influential woman who's the president's wife of the college that's in town, and she's really important in this. And what he did was he recognized the groups, and he knew the people within the groups that were kind of like the movers and shakers in the group. And then he said, he handed me the piece of paper back, and he says, if you get those people involved, you're not going to have any trouble with this project. I said, okay, thanks. And I went back to the people that had hired me. I put it on the desk of the guy that was at the desk. And I said, well, here's your plan. Here's your organizational chart. And he looks at it and says, man, if you got all those people, we'd have a winning team. And I said, well, up here in the top, I says, you need to get Dale Vandenberg, because he was the guy that gave me all the information. If you can get him to recruit these people, I think you're going to be home free. In 3 months, we raised $5 million. We actually oversubscribed to the process. And it was done. But you know, many times, you know, if you don't ask anybody, about 3 months after, and you probably have had this happen to you, about 3 months after, you'll hear someone say, I could have told you you shouldn't have done that. And we kind of knew it was going to happen. We knew there was going to be a train wreck. We were just all gathering at the train tracks just to watch the wreck happen. And you think, you know, but if you had asked me, I would have told you. Well, why don't you just ask first rather than to face the consequences later? Anyway, that's it. It's a joy to be with you guys. Thanks so much.